The All Souls Forum is a weekly broadcast here on KKFI every Thursday at noon. The All Souls Forum is a production of the Universalist Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. Each week they present a public forum whose mission is to deal with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world, and to promote critical thinking. So without further ado, here's this week's production of All Souls Forum.
Good morning. I'm George Baggett, a member of the Forum Committee at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. We welcome you all to the Zoom Forum. This forum's mission is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world, and most importantly, to promote critical thinking. Until we can resume our meetings in the church, we're going to continue with Zoom meetings. So far, the Zoom meetings have allowed us to continue with informative and interesting programs. With this in mind, this morning, I'm really pleased to introduce my friend Neil Selbin from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who will discuss opportunities to develop end use of recycled materials. Neil and his organization were instrumental in helping Kansas City develop plans for the current recycling system that we've had. And maybe time for some refurbishment or adding on to that, but the changes with China, with changes with the materials that are in this system, and some of the materials that are not recycled, Neil's got a little perspective that maybe we should be hearing from. So, Neil, it's your show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in Kansas City this Sunday morning, and especially with old friends. So I will talk for about half an hour and hope that I can stimulate a lot of discussion. And I understand from George that John Kerman is going to be speaking in a few weeks, more specifically about Kansas City. So that will be interesting, and I will certainly listen in. So I'll introduce the Institute in a second. I'm going to talk for a half hour. We hope that we get a good discussion. And my general picture framework is going to be, what situation is the country in with solid waste management from the eyes of a decentralist, someone that wants to bring decision-making and actually technology and processing back to the local level? And I'll explain how recycling started at the local level, has been taken away, and now we're trying to get back. At the very end, I'll talk a little bit about Kansas City, and of course, we'll learn much more of that in May from John Kerman. So the Institute is a 47, 48-year-old organization. We started as a community group in the Adams-Morgan section of Washington, D.C., which is a neighborhood, two neighborhoods up from downtown D.C., I work on waste with my colleague, Brenda Platt, who focuses on composting, and I work on recycling issues. We also have other initiatives on decentralized energy, decentralized broadband, and independent business and finance initiative. And of late, we've been in the news mainly because Stacy Mitchell, who directs our business and finance initiative, is also one of the leading anti-monopolist resources for Congress. So she's been getting a lot of play. So my job was to look at this solid waste situation and try to figure out how citizens can get what they want. Kansas City, like the rest of us, are living in between two giant monopoly systems, the monopoly companies that produce the stuff we want. Every industry is controlled by three or four major corporations. And at the other end, when we want to get rid of our waste, we're dealing with another set of monopolies, the Waste Management Inks of the world, Republics of the world. In that, we're literally in the middle, and we have to figure out what to do, or else we will be inundated by garbage incinerators and other forms of inappropriate disposal of garbage. This country went through a garbage incinerator phase. We went through several over the last 100 years, but the most recent was the 1970s to the 1990s, in which about 350 incinerators have been defeated in the planning stage by organized citizens. And it's been a fascinating ride. But like Dracula, if you don't drive a stake through his heart, these incinerators come back, and they're coming back now, proposals are coming back now, which we will discuss. Finally, before I get into some facts, I want to say, who started the recycling movement in the United States? Well, I get asked that question a lot. And every time I'm in an audience such as this, I say, turn around and look at who's sitting next to you, because common people made this happen. It literally started in the 68, 69, when there was a survival walk from San Diego to Sacramento. It was anti-war, anti-climate degradation. And every night when these people walked from San Diego to Sacramento, wherever they stopped, they had a drop-off center, recycling center, just to demonstrate what people can do to address what seems to be an insurmountable problem. Well, those drop-off centers that metastasized, if you will, around 2000. Thousands of them were started mostly by women. Backyards, old gas stations, vacant lots became drop-off centers. And then by the 80s, companies, community-based companies, Garbaggio's in Eugene, Portland Recycling Team in Portland, all across the country, small collection companies started, mostly community-based. Eventually, by the 1980s, cities took over the systems. And it was an amazing development. I don't have my charts, but if you go to our webpage, which I'll announce, you can see all the charts. From 1970 to the year 2000, you could see a steady but significant growth from roughly zero post-consumer recycling to the year 2000 to 35%, all because of grassroots people doing it themselves and then working with their cities, organizing, and getting the cities to take over. At that point in the late 1990s, the Wall Street discovered, hey, our garbage companies, which we've been financing through stock options, is losing money because of recycling. I could go into details. We have all of this documented. The result was that single stream of recycling kicked in because of these big companies, because it saved them collection time. But if you look at the processing and marketing, the cost you save in collection was lost in efficiency and efficacy on the other side. And as a result, from roughly 2000 to now, the recycling rate stagnated at 35%. The last couple of years, it went down 3% to 32%. It would have gone down more, except that composting kicked in, which is another phenomenon which we could focus on. So as the recycling groups were taking effect, there was a similar development, rather a parallel development, with the big waste companies. Starting in the late 50s, 60s, they consolidated into vertically integrated national companies. This did not lead to any efficiency of collection or disposal. In fact, efficiency went down, but profits soared. And as a result, we have a situation now where the monopolies over collection, landfill, now force us to deal with monopoly rules. And as a result of that, the cost of recycling has soared. I'll get into that right now. The system, this collection system, as you know, with single stream, more people participated, but not more people were recycling because the level of contaminants in the single stream system was so great, 20, 30, 40%, that the recycling rate stayed the same, as I mentioned. Then the system collapsed because sloppy recycling, single stream recycling, it doesn't have to be sloppy, but the way that Waste Management Inc. and Republic and the big companies did it was so sloppy that the Chinese in the year 2013 said, if you keep on sending us this stuff, we're not going to buy it anymore. American companies did absolutely nothing. 4 years later, the Chinese said, okay, we're doing it. We're cutting you off. And of course, Big Waste complained that they needed more time. It's not fair, et cetera. But the Chinese had their own reasons for doing that internal, as well as they didn't want to be cleaning up the world's garbage anymore. They also had their own environmental pressures, even though it's a totalitarian system. You can get victories. If you get a victory, you won't go to jail, but if you go to the next town and told them how you got your victory, then you will go to jail. So it's quite a system. So what's happening now, as I see it, is that recycling is reviving in incredible ways. A massive investment, private sector investment in paper mills, plastic. The American companies have discovered that if they keep it clean, they've got an industrial product and they could sell it to paper mills, plastic, et cetera. And in fact, many of the companies that were sending plastic over to the Chinese years ago are now processing it themselves into the pellets, and they're selling pellets, which are much more valuable than raw recycled plastic. So cities are, private sector is investing, the the value or the price of recyclables went down because of the Chinese program. I could give you details, but the bottom line is that paper, recycled paper became valuable, and American companies are gobbling it up and making new paper out of it. Their biggest competitor are the Chinese, who are building their own mills in the United States to get clean materials for their home industries in China. Cities are taking over processing from these companies. They are passing incredibly new laws, minimum content, unit pricing, where you pay for your garbage pickup, but you don't pay for recyclables or composting, bans of single-stream plastic, landfill bans. Four states in the country will not allow any recyclable, compostable, or reusable in their landfill, North Carolina, Vermont, Wisconsin, and another state. But it's just like what happened at the year 2000. This is such an incredible threat to the big waste companies that they've done two things. Excuse me, the waste companies have done one thing and the producers have done another. The waste companies have taken over recycling. They have invested and now control over over 50% of the capacity to process recyclables in the country. They did this because recycling, independent recycling, is a safety valve, an escape valve from the monopoly system. So they have the landfills tied up. They have the hauling tied up. They had to tie up the escape valve. So now they control recycling. And since the Chinese import ban, they have invested hundreds of millions into improving a bad system, improving single stream. And in fact, I was just sent a quote from the CEO of Waste Management Inc. And he was explaining that we have to build these big systems to separate stuff because Americans, they can separate it themselves. And that actually is more efficient. But Americans are lazy. So we give them this big bin and we'll separate it for them. Admitting that dual stream or multi-stream systems are far more efficient, but they don't give the profits to these big companies. Now, you may know, and it may have been happening in Kansas City, in Missouri, and some other issues, that when corporations don't get their way, they go to the state and preempt local activity. And that's exactly what's happening on plastic bags, bottle bills, and California cities are restrained from passing new packaging regulations because of this preemption. Well, right now, there's a bill called the Breaking Free from Plastic Bill. It's an incredible phenomenon. 400 environmental groups have signed on to it. This is an informal discussion, so I'll bet about 10% of them know what's in the bill. The others have signed on because other big organizations have signed on. The bill is both wonderful and terrifying at the same time. It's wonderful because it could establish a national bottle bill. It could moratorium on virgin plastic production, ban on single-use plastics, and many other wonderful things. Perhaps the best of the bill is it makes environmental justice and environmental racism a core planning policy. You have to have those concepts in your plan to move forward, which is very important, as we all know. I refer to environmental justice and racial justice as the bedrock of the foundation of a circular economy and getting to zero waste. I also point out that those zero waste and circular economy are inherently decentralist, bringing decision-making to the local level as much as possible. It's very parallel to the Catholic principle of subsidiarity. Handle problems at the local level. If you can't, you go to the next level up. The bad part about the EPR bill, about this Breaking Free from Plastic bill, is that it gives control of the whole system to the plastics industry. It's mind-boggling for any environmental activist to see groups like Greenpeace and the Surf Riders, et cetera, very good environmental organizations, saying we cannot control plastic. The only people that can control plastic pollution are the people who are producing it. And therefore, we're going to give them the whole system. Take control of all city recycling, everything. It all goes to the private sector. They will make the rules. There will be advisory committees, but they make the rules, and those rules have the force of law. It is absolutely crazy for anyone who has been in the environmental movement to abdicate this way. And yet these leading organizations are pushing it. Why? That's another discussion which we could have at another time. But the point is that, in my opinion, on this issue, I don't want to generalize, on this issue, the environmental community is losing sight and they're opening themselves up to unintended consequences, meaning Coke and Pepsi and the people who produce their plastic become the legislature when it comes to solid waste management. It's quite insane. I have written extensively on this. If you go to our webpage, you can see all the arguments. The most amazing thing I find is that three organizations, all three good groups, National Recycling Coalition, the Sierra Club, and the National Sierra Club, and GAIA, Global Anti-Incineration Alliance, wonderful national group that's hooked up internationally. And I've spent years talking to these people, and eventually, within the last 6 months or so, each of them has come out with a very clear policy question on extended producer responsibility. The principle is the polluter pays, but by giving over control to the industry, the pollution pays principle, which is wonderful, becomes a polluter control principle, which is anathema to everything we want to do. In those three organizations, they have come to agree with us that the best way to use extended producer responsibility is to have what's called a municipal reimbursement system. Instead of the big companies using their own capital to create their own recycling system, which I'm convinced will be mediocre, those companies pay into a fund to compensate the public for the imposition impacts that their garbage and their recyclable materials pose to the public. And that money gets to a state or federal agency, preferably state, that redistributes the money to cities and towns, which means cities and towns can continue to make the decisions, but they have a regular flow of revenue to compensate them to expand and deepen their programs. And you don't have to give up the right to vote. That's the other insidious thing. If we all know that recycling and the environmental movement is where it's at because of organized citizens and the right to vote, and the right for purchasing power. Well, if EPR comes in under producer or monopoly control, there's no more voting. Citizens, cities and counties have abdicated their vote. The big corporations make the decisions. So this is a rather high level preemption. The Institute has been organizing groups against this. We have been accused by the environmental and racial injustice as undermining these good movements. Other environmentalists say, Neil, keep on going because these people need a kick in the pants. They're doing something that's very silly. Okay, so that's the dilemma that's happening. It's happening right now in front of Congress. The bill has been proposed. There's a lot of talk about it. I'm sure you've gotten emails, announcements of webinars on EPR. Virtually all of them are propaganda. They don't allow for cross-examination. They don't point out the obvious flaws that we are seeing when the system gets implemented. So that's the struggle. We could talk more about it. But to get to Kansas City is unique and has done wonderful things. Because of the single stream recycling, you're not getting your glass processed through your collection program, which means it's inefficient. And the reason why is the equipment that these companies use just is the wrong equipment for getting glass out. They take the glass out, but it's of such poor quality that it can't be marketed. Therefore, they use the material for free, basically, because they charge people to tip it, and then they get it and use it for landfill cover and roadways within the landfill. At the same time, they issue their propaganda statements saying, well, we'd like to recycle glass, but there are no markets for it. This is absolutely false, as proven in Kansas City and many other cities across the country. The industry wants the glass. They, without the glass, they can't produce products for four important industries. To give you one sense of it, there's a Wilson, North Carolina has a glass plant that processes 100,000 tons of glass a year, and it sells it to bottling companies, insulation companies, abrasive companies, and the construction industry. Well, as that 100,000 tons a year gets dispersed through the region, they're supporting 2,300 jobs in these various other factories, and they cannot get enough glass. And that's because all the major MRF operators aren't producing glass. They can if they invest in it, but they prefer to ignore it, even though it is 20 to 25% of your waste stream. So what the company, I believe it's Ripple in Kansas City, has done a great thing by setting up these drop-off centers, allowing the glass to flow to the industry. And of course, the glass from drop-off is much cleaner and better than from mixed waste systems. So companies are reacting to get a raw material that they need and overcome the propaganda of these companies. Now you can process single stream materials and get the glass out, but the key is, do you want to get it out? You can have the key to getting good processing is who owns the facility and does the owner want to recycle? What you have now is Waste Management Inc. and Republic, et cetera. They own the systems and they have no incentive to recycle glass. If they do, we'll pressure them. But well, there are many other intricacies within their planning system. They make cities send their materials far out of town. That's not the case in Kansas City. But in my city, Washington, D.C., we now have to send our recyclables 25 miles away, 30,000 tons a year, $17 a ton a trip. That's $500,000 that we're paying to get our materials for them to use without paying us. Actually, we pay them a $25 surcharge. And the thing is, they drove into bankruptcy a local minority-owned dual-stream processing company in the city with 20 jobs. They lowballed the contract to get it away from them, and then that company went out of business, and then they start raising the price, changing the service, and cities like D.C. are captured. And that's what we're fighting. And I also understand that there are the landfill situation in your area. These are very complex issues. I can only point out that in San Jose, about 15, 20 years ago, there were two landfills, one by Waste Management and one by Republic. And the county, the city of San Jose announced that they are looking for a third company to build another landfill. Right after that, they announced that they were going to look into this, the cost of landfilling from those two companies dropped because they were afraid of competition. So there are many strategies and tactics, and the big problem is concentration and bigness. So in the future of Kansas City, I would think of terms of composting, unit pricing, and hopefully getting control of a city processing plant and a city-owned or publicly-owned landfill would be ideal. That's a long way in coming, but I think that's the direction that Kansas City should be thinking in with regard to waste and recycling. And I think I will stop there and hope that there are questions and discussion.
Thank you, Neil. Well, I've got everybody's attention. Next week, our forum will be about the Oscars. Diane Cassidy is organizing with the Fine Arts Film Group to discuss the recent films and what's happening in Kansas City. We have Richard up first. Go ahead, Richard.
Does President Biden's plan for environmental change include anything about localizing recycling?
Yes and no. There are several infrastructure bills. I don't know the name of them. I can get you them if you want to look further. But what's happening is you have to pressure the agencies. And in fact, the National Recycling Coalition, many groups are pressuring the administration, the cabinet members, to include infrastructure for recycling and composting and reuse as part of a focus area, a priority in recycling, a priority in investment in infrastructure. So the money is there, and we, meaning the recycling community, if you will, needs to organize to make sure the money is put in the right bucket, if you will. We think that the best way to get money into the system now, which is needed, is for state surcharges or county surcharges, meaning if you have Alameda County, California has a landfill. They get something like $6, $8 for every ton that goes in. It's added to the price of solid waste management in the county. And they raise about $10 million a year for investment in recycling, composting, and reuse, private sector investment as well as public. Other states, Pennsylvania has a statewide surcharge. Cities have had surcharges to build their infrastructure. The other area that we think cities should get money through is through taxing packages, which is happening in Europe, particularly a plastic package that has two different types of plastic should be charged to dissuade companies from using that type of plastic of packaging. So getting money into the system, and if in the 60s and 70s, the feds poured and still do, poured hundreds of billions of dollars into sewage treatment and water safety for cities and counties. No money went to cities and counties to protect their landfills. As a result of that, we have the monopolization of landfills. We need the feds to stand up and not necessarily give money, which they can, but to encourage states to do the same thing. For instance, if you want your state of Missouri to pass a surcharge on and get that money investing, the feds could say, well, for any state that passes a surcharge to support recycling, composting, and reuse, we're going to match it with 10%, 50%, whatever. So we need to get the money to the cities and counties, not to the big corporations, because the cities and counties have citizens like us who are very radical on this issue. I mean, not throwing bombs, but getting to the root cause, which is stop wasting, not trying to deal with waste.
Craig, you're up.
I had not heard about this bill in Congress you were talking about. You called it CPR, I think.
It's called the Break Free from Plastic Bill.
Right. I'm curious as who originated this bill? Who are the original people behind it?
Gee, that's a radical question. It goes right to the heart of it, and I've been trying to find out. I know who's against it. Who's against it are the waste industry, the big waste industry, because they've got their monopoly. They don't want the big Fortune 500, Coca-Cola and Pepsi to come in and renegotiate contracts. So the private sector is basically against it. The best I could figure, it's Coke, Pepsi and Nestle's. And in 2013, they started this push for EPR. And I could send you the articles that they promoted and pushed it out. I think they're behind it, and they've got a lot of allies. I do want to point out, though, that besides voting power, which citizens can vote at the local level to ban this or that, which is great, there's also purchasing power. And if you watch TV recently, you will see that Coke, Pepsi, and those big companies have ads on, we are using 100% recycled content, or we will be using that recycled materials to make our packaging. Now, that was a pledge that's 30 or 40 years old. But what's happening now is the pressure on these companies to be green is so great that they may be getting scared that they in order to keep promoting their putting their products out there, that they need to gain control of the supply chain of secondary materials so they can control it and they could meet any minimum content requirements. That's one explanation. It's plausible. I can't say it's the only explanation. The real villains in this, those companies are villains. Coke and Pepsi will push the world to extinction if they're given. But it's the liberal congressman, this guy Lowenthal, Udall. Why are they going for this BS? I don't understand it. And another reason is, why is Greenpeace pushing for this? Why is Surfrider pushing for this? It's because they don't have faith in people. They don't have faith in local government. And yet local government and the people organized to push it are the ones who made recycling happen in this country. And the fact that these environmental groups would rather work with a monopoly to take control over something that citizens are perfectly capable of planning and overseeing and implementing, it's so disappointing that it's very hard to say. And right now, people are saying that Neil is causing all this trouble because he's undermining the racial and environmental justice movement. That's what the white environmentalists tell me. The one black environmentalist that I got a chance to talk to said, Neil, keep on going. These people need a kick in the butt because they're going in the wrong direction. I have meetings coming up with the leading environmental and racial justice people. We're mobilizing against the Greenpeaces of the world. And it's terrible. We should be working together. Instead, they went ahead and went this EPR giveaway system without consulting anyone. And now we have this dilemma. The environmental community is split, and it's not the first time that grassroots people don't like what the big environmental groups are doing. And that there are many issues that where that's the case. And of course, we would like to see the big environmental groups responsible to local decision making.
Carol Fields, you're up.
I always throw out this one dealing with the issue of plastic bags and groceries, other stores too. Many stores give credit for reusing bags, right? This last year, it's all a mess, but And I feel guilty every time I pick up my groceries out the door and I tell them, and I hand back all those damn plastic bags and I write down every time as few bags as possible. And then they offer paper and I'm going, that's not any better. They'll still put three items and give me 20 bags and it'll take a three. Well, anyway, so my notion is, okay, so we have a pattern and companies are used to dealing with hitting a button to give people a discount. Why not hit a button to charge them for every plastic bag that's new? And they just have a sticker that goes on a bag when it goes by them. And they don't even have to look and see if there's been a sticker before or not, as long as it's pretty adhesive, sticks on there, unless you tear those flimsy bags, right? So it's right in the process. And if the state says you can't ban plastics, which has been up for many states, including Kansas, this isn't banning. So I just like to hear another person give opinion on that.
I agree.
Possibility.
Other people may want to respond. I agree with you 100%. In D.C., if you get a bag, whether it's paper or plastic, you pay a nickel. I agree. I think that's a very good remedy. It's not a ban. It's a fee.
Mine, of course, suggests that you actually bring it back and use the same bag again.
Of course, that's the idea. And many people.
I see yours is what you're talking about in D.C. is simpler, which makes sense.
On the chat there, John Kerman is essentially saying that the Break Free from Plastics is sponsored by Jeff Merkey of Oregon, Democrat, yes. And then Alan Lowenthal, Democrat of California. Go ahead, John. You're up.
Good morning. One thing I think would probably be helpful for everyone on here is if you would describe the difference between a single stream recycling system as we have here primarily in Kansas City and what you mean by dual stream recycling.
Thank you. A very good thing to define. A single stream, of course, is putting all your recyclables, glass, plastic, etc., in one bin. Collected, it gets crushed and moved around in the big truck, and then it has to be separated in a processing plant. The dual stream system would keep one of those materials, either glass or paper, separate. And that's because when glass is mixed in and crushed and so forth, it breaks and it contaminates the plastic and the paper by embedding shards of glass in it, which of course is not good for recycling. So in some communities, Montgomery County here, which is the largest across the street here from D.C., Montgomery County is the largest community, 1 million people in the U.S. that uses dual stream. There are two small cities in the county that use single stream, but the rest of the county. You have two bins. You have your rolling cart where only you put in paper. And then you have your laundry bin where you put in your other stuff, which basically is air, bottles and cans and stuff. And what happens is the truck comes by, the paper, which is very heavy, a week's or 2 weeks worth of paper is pretty heavy. So it's in a cart and a mechanical arm dumps it into the truck. The worker by hand dumps the other stuff into another section of the truck. And that goes to the processing center, and your capital investment and procedures in processing are much cheaper because the stuff is not mixed and you can have specialized lines for processing. Other countries, I'll mention Japan and Italy for two of them, go much further. You have your glass, you have your paper, you have seven or eight different compartments, and those are picked up and kept separate. Those are extraordinary countries, Japan, because everyone is living on top of each other. They obey the rules. And in Italy, it's a result of an incredible anti-incineration, anti-mafia campaign that was led by heroic people, Rossano Ercolini, Enzo Fabrio, I'm mispronouncing their names, and Paul Connett has been back and forth to Italy organizing for probably 50 times in the last 20 years. So those countries, for different reasons, are doing a multi-separation, but a dual stream system in which you keep either paper or glass separate is what I'm talking about mostly.
Kansas City has a composting facility that was actually started by the city taking yard waste and the like and trees and whatever. We had actually a fire in Kansas City where one of the tree disposal site caught on fire and took months to essentially get the fire put out. Anyway, that's all well and good. What do you think about the idea of composting food waste and other kinds of waste that are compostable that might end up in the landfill prior to being put in a landfill?
All that material should never be put in the landfill, and certainly not an incinerator. And in fact, several states, about 20 states, ban yard debris and food waste from landfills because it's so easy to deal with if you keep it separately. Brenda Platt, who's my colleague and knows far more about what's going on, she was invited to be with me today. She couldn't make it, but in the future, she could come back at some point. We call our program distributed composting, meaning the first place to start is your backyard. Train people, educate people, give them bins. Every time a family puts their food waste in their backyard composting, 15% of their waste disappears forever. DC, Baltimore, give people, I don't know, $30-$40 to buy one of these things because it saves the city a fortune over the lifetime of the future of that household. Then comes food production through community programs, and they're proliferating all over the country. There are networks in which we can show you. Brenda Platt and her staff coordinate a compost forum twice a year. 90 or so compost entrepreneurs, including bike companies that pick up stuff by bike. Fascinating entrepreneurs, just like in the early days of recycling. So that level of distributed composting backyard and community might get you 20% out of your waste stream. The other 80% has to be dealt with facilities. Depending upon the size of your city, you may need one or two, which makes sense for two reasons. Cities are big. You want your trucks to be able to go to the drop-off site and get right back on route. So it's good to have two in different parts of the city. There are many government programs that are doing this. Baltimore has Camp Small, which composts stuff and then gives it back to the city for their projects. All of these things are happening very dramatically. Composting is the fastest growing component of the waste stream, and the companies and the technology, low-tech technology being developed is quite thrilling. As I said, you could go to ilsr.org/compost and pick up the terrific reports that Brenda and her team has done. She'll tell you how many jobs will be created, how much tons of water will be created per ton of compost, etc. And compost of organics, rather, is one-third of the waste stream, and you need shredded yard debris to mix with your food waste to get good compost. So it's very simple. And for those of you like myself who are quite lazy, I have a bin, I throw the stuff in, I don't look at it, and a year later, I'm digging it out with beautiful black stuff, which my wife and I now are putting on our garden. So composting is very, very important, and it takes away one-third of the waste from the waste stream. And it's cost-effective. There's a wonderful article by our colleague Jeffrey Morris out of Sound Resource Management in Seattle. He's an economist. He's done a study on what happens when Seattle went to composting and recycling, and when they implemented composting, it reduced the overall cost of solid waste in that city of about 600,000-700,000 people, which I think is comparable to Kansas City. I'm not sure.
Okay, Carol, you're up again.
Thanks for talking about Japan. Well, I visited my brother there now 20 years ago. My sister-in-law had this huge chart, right? They don't speak Japanese, right? And they lived there a year, and she's trying to figure out what's recycled what day, because it was not only separated, it was a different day of the week. And everything's so close, you don't have room to put out 20 bins the way people live. So I imagine that's why it's part of the why it's a different day of the week. And I just think that's fantastic. But, you know, you have to be willing, and we got too much space, so we throw everything away. Anyway, my question is, between you and our other folks here, do we know how poorly waste management focuses on recycling? Do they really? I get the notion they don't care if your paper is wet or not, because they're going to put it out in the rain and it's never going to get recycled anyway. That kind of thing.
Well, their systems are very inefficient. Sometimes their contamination is up to 20%. And they're making massive investments to get that 20% down low. I'll give you, just by comparison, a good dual stream processing system, you would have 3 to 5% contamination. Really? So 20% is beyond bad, if you will, from an efficiency point of view, of course. And the other thing is they don't get the glass, which is then is wasted. We can't reuse it. And of course, glass is so beautiful that you could recycle it forever. It just turns into sand and you reuse it. So the challenge is to get people to act more Japanese, if you will, or more Italian. And we think the way to do that in the United States with a market economy is what we call unit pricing, or pay as you throw, save as you throw. And there are several names for it. And basically what it says is that every time you, Carol, put out your bag of garbage or can of garbage, you have to pay a certain amount of money. But you don't have to pay when you put out recyclables or compostables for curbside pickup. And as a result of that, you can keep your weekly, monthly, yearly garbage bill low if you recycle and compost, but also if you buy differently. If people who have to pay to get rid of stuff, when they buy something, they look at it differently than when you just throw it in your garbage and you don't pay. The other thing is that pay as you throw, or unit pricing, puts a price on something like your light bulb or your heating bill. If you didn't have to pay by BTU, whatever, we'd be very wasteful people, but we pay for our energy, we pay for the gas in our car, so we're somewhat conscious about it. So we think the economic incentive plus education, get those kids, get your grandchildren, your 3 and 4 year olds to start recycling and composting. There's a wonderful series of articles about kids who are cut off from nature called Nature Deficit Disorder. Put a compost bin in your backyard and let your kid look at the ants and the worms and all that stuff. And they become literate in nature, which is, of course, essential.
So I'm wondering about how you monitor that then. I think there are a lot of people who don't like it, who just say, well, hell, I'll put everything in the recycle bin, and then it's totally contaminated. I'm wondering about the whole issue of separating them by of not doing it every week. Or garbage is an issue, you know, because you have things in there that might not be food, or that really aren't at all edible, and that you don't want sitting around. It's a health issue, right? But
You hit the nail on your head. And if you keep your garbage out of, if you keep your organics out of your garbage, it's much cleaner garbage. You can hold your garbage another a week. You could also hold your recyclables once a week. And we do advise that once every other week collection of recycling is very doable. If you have that weekly collection, you get about 4% more per household in recyclables. But if you go to once every other week, you sacrifice that 4%, but you can save 20% of your cost. So going every other week makes a whole lot of sense. And of course, it makes sense to keep your organics out of your garbage because then your garbage won't stink. Carol, if I could just say, we think economic incentives and education will turn people around. And it has worked in the past.
Craig, you're up.
Yeah, I came back on mainly as we talked earlier before the forum. We have John Fish Kerman, who's going to do the second stage of this discussion, which is what's happening locally in Kansas City. That'll be May 16th. And if you have any questions, specifically wondering about what's happening in Kansas City, would you bring these up, raise your hand and bring these up before? Well, you could wait till this discussion afterwards, but please bring out any questions so John can research those for you by May 16th.
Okay, Richard, you're up.
Hi. Is there any current legislation or anything in President Biden's plan about making composting free for people so it's more, you know, convenient and easy?
I'm not aware of anything that specific. If the infrastructure money is spent on composting, recycling, that would be a source of money. But composting is not very expensive to implement. Now, you may have to, a city or a region, a county, may have to invest in a composting processing system. Prince George's County, which is to the east of Washington, D.C., about 900,000 people, they built their own composting system after the private sector failed to do it. And they built theirs to have excess capacity. Private companies and the other cities are sending their organics, clean organics, to Prince George's County and paying a tip fee, which has helped to amortize their investment. Just north of Prince George's County is Howard County. They implemented their own composting program, but they built a facility exclusively for their county, meaning they scaled it to deal with the stuff coming out of their county. So counties and cities have different options. In DC, it's almost impossible to build a processing facility. You need 15, 20 acres. 15 to 20 acres in DC costs more than the national debt probably. So DC has to go outside the city. From what I understand, Kansas City is a spacious city, and you probably can find space for that. But I do understand that there's a private composting company operating, and that's fine too. Private, public, as long as haulers and people, if you have a drop-off system, have access to it at reasonable cost to get rid of their source-separated organics. Of course, the cheapest is for people to keep it in their backyard and use the finished product for their garden.
Okay, Claudine.
Oh, the more you talk, Jim, the more questions I have. But I will try to keep it to one question and hope I get to ask the others. Which is very personal. I have donated for many, many, many years to Greenpeace and to Sierra Club. And how can I let them know that I don't approve of what they're doing?
Well, first of all, these are very good organizations. Please keep contributing to them.
I know.
Good. The Sierra Club, I think you mentioned the Sierra Club, their policy position on extended producer responsibility is quite good. It took 2 years talking to them, but they now say we need EPR, but we don't need the companies to take control. We need them to pay into a fund that the money will reimburse cities for their expenses. So that's terrific. As far as Greenpeace, I could give you the names of the two people to contact. I'll give them to you now. I would like to talk to you, if we can, after this meeting about how you might approach them. But the two people is the director, Annie Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, and I can send you.
I know the name.
Oh, good. And the person at Greenpeace who is in charge of this particular issue, extended producer responsibility, his name is John Hocevar, H-O-C-E-V-A-R. And I disagree with them on this particular issue, but these are good environmental organizers, and we don't want to start feuds because we disagree on one issue. So I would contact them. I'd be happy to talk to you offline, give you an update of what's happening. In fact, I'll be happy to send you. I'm about to send Annie Leonard a letter, bringing her up to date on what we're doing to fight her. She's a friend, so we're being quite honest, which I think is good. I'll be happy to send that to you, and you could write your own letter. But clearly, you could say you heard me present, and you have these questions, which is perfectly legit.
Well, how important are petitions?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. I think they're important. But I don't think you have to go overboard by getting 10,000 or something. I think in your area, the Kansas City area, and your group, if you would get 10, 15, 25, 30 people to sign on to a letter asking these questions, I think that's perfectly legitimate. And as I learned from years ago from my friend Marie Sampson, every letter has an impact. A letter on the environment from a businessman has a bigger impact than a letter from an environmentalist, but they all have impacts. The best impact is have young people, high schoolers, send letters. Every politician pays attention to young people.
I've got a question for you, Neil. Is it, you know, we have a group called Restore It, or a facility called Restore It, which collects, what Dan Knapp has been doing, collects materials for construction materials, and it's amazing facility, a set of facilities, actually. And that was set up by the group that John works for at one time, Bridging the Gap, and then they were able to turn it over to Habitat for Humanity. So they took it on. The compost facility was also a facility that was set up by the city. And they were able to turn that over to a private business. a local private business. My thought is for the city to turn these over to private organizations, they kind of lose control. But then if they choose well, they have companies that can take the project and take it for a long time and actually maybe make improvements upon on the way. What do you think about that?
I think those reuse stores are essential. They are essential psychologically, economically, and socially. If you follow the stores that George mentioned, Urban Ore, they're popping up all over in Gainesville Repurpose Center. They're expanding. They're buying their own buildings. It's very important for income distribution. St. Vincent de Paul in Lane County has 13 thrift stores. They sell, you know, $100 items at pennies on the dollar, and their motto, their modus operandi is, if you can't afford it, take it anyway. These are essential organizations, and I commend Kansas City for having it, whether it's nonprofit. Most of these are nonprofit, although Urban Ore is for-profit. It could be either one. And if the government doesn't want to run these things but could set the stage, help them buy their building, encourage, support these types of businesses, it's very critical. As we said earlier, I think it was before we formally were involved in the presentation, I used to, as a kid, take my father's shirts to a shirt hospital to put the collars back on and the lamps get repaired and so forth, the vacuum cleaners. All of those places have fallen apart. And there's a wonderful book, which I highly recommend, called The Repair Revolution. I happen to have it right here because we just had a webinar with the author, Elizabeth Knight. And it's a great book, Repair Revolution, How Fixes Are Transforming Our Throwaway Culture. John Wackman, who unfortunately just passed away, and Elizabeth Knight. And it's a volunteer culture. Read about these things. It's just like the old Apple clubs when the Apple computers came out. People are volunteering their time not only to fix things for people, but to train people to fix things themselves. And these are growing networks. And it's really a very important part of the civil society and training people to think of their items as valuable items with embedded energy, embedded labor, embedded smarts. So these things, a terrific habitat, has restores, they call them. They have manuals, how other groups can start them. There are just wonderful organizations all across the country that are doing these things.
Carol's got a question. So
mine's a little mundane, but I saw a program recently that said basically only 1 in 2 plastics numbered were commonly recycled, but the plastic producers lobbied to have all plastics numbered because it looked better.
Yep, true.
You're nodding. That is evidently true. Well, yes. Can you tell me, on those 1 in 2 plastics, a lot of the time they have paper slapped on them so that you can't get it off. Does that make it unrecyclable?
No. Those labels and caps, they are taken out during the recycling process and the reformulation of the nodules. Forget what they're called. The little plastic pellets, but it is important because except for 1 in 2, there's very little recycling going on, but there is massive investment in recovering polypropylene, usually the caps on these bottles and cans, and film plastic, which have not been recycled. European companies are coming in and building facilities that are creating markets for this material. But at the same time, the chemical industry, Dow, Monsanto, the hefty bags, they are saying, well, this low-grade plastic, you can't do anything. So we're going to build little incinerators all across the country and start burning plastic. Well, I don't have any plastic here, but if you had a plastic bottle, you could lick it. And it's not going to harm you. If you could burn it, it's going to put it in the air and it can harm you. So burning plastic is the worst thing you can do for our environmental situation. And yet there is literally a competition. There are about 20 new companies that want the low-grade plastics for mechanical recycling, new production. And there are the Monsantos and the Dows that want to burn it all up. And that is happening right now. And they're the anti-incineration groups, the zero waste groups, et cetera. We're gearing up to try to stop that. And I will keep you all informed of actions that citizens and groups can take as this issue comes forward.
Claudine, you got something or?
I did compost, but I'm at the point now in my life where I can't handle it. And that goes also for the people that live in these huge apartment complexes. What's the thought on handling it? It seems to me like they should have each apartment building should have some way of helping their tenants.
Right. And for new apartment buildings, it's a simple process. You could build your trash room, if you will, into a recycling room with the proper chutes to go down for different things. It's almost impossible to retrofit an existing building. And multi-housing or multi-unit recycling and composting is very difficult. It is being done, however, and I can connect you to cities and housing groups that are doing very well with recycling, including big housing complexes sharing boxes when people move in and things like that. There are ways to do it. It is one of the most challenging aspects of recycling and composting, and different cities are doing it in different ways. I'll be happy to connect people if that is an issue you want to explore.
So our last question is Michael Hoy before we stop our recording, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, Michael?
Yeah, there was a video I saw on Deutsche Welle, something that was being done in India with the plastic film waste. They were chewing it up and then heating it up and converting it into a diesel-like fuel that people could use that apparently is much healthier for the people in their cook stoves. And I'm wondering, is there any future on a larger scale?
Yes. They're planning that on a larger scale. And the environmental experts, I'm not a scientist, but the environmental experts I talk to are very concerned about that process. There's a gentleman named Michael Ewall, E-W-A-L-L. His organization is Energy Justice Network. He is one of the top experts on that issue. And I will get you his email. But you could go to his webpage, which is energyjustice.net. And he will be able to give you a very scientific answer on that. Well, there are other people too. The Gaia, the group I mentioned, Global Anti-Incineration Alliance, they have an excellent report on called chemical recycling, which is a euphemism for burning plastics and getting a diesel fuel. So those are the experts. Gaia, their webpage is noburn.org, and then Mike Ewall, and you'll get full explanations of what happens in those processes that environmentalists are concerned about.
Well, look, Renee, if you'll turn off the recording, I think we've had it for the day.
Thank you for tuning in to All Souls Forum. Keep your dial tuned right here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your jazz afternoon coming up immediately with KC, followed by the Boogie Bridge with Jason Bavoni at 3 p.m., and then the Heartland Labor Forum, 6 p.m. this evening. In the meantime, have a great day.